Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. Sorry for the delay in this podcast. It's supposed to be out on Friday, but today is Saturday, I think. So this podcast is coming live from my car as I'm driving up the A9 from Stirling to Inverness in Scotland. So it's not a good day outside. It's like pouring with rain, and it's been the last few days have been pretty crappy weather up here. So it's been a little bit like being back in Ireland. So I was like doing my deep water driving skills. I was in the Lake District. Stayed in the Lake District for a few days, and I had to drive. You know, I don't know if you've ever driven through like really deep water. So the trick, if you don't know, is you want to get into like a low gear, like second gear, and you just have to keep going. Don't stop. Like if you stop, then the water gets sucked into your exhaust pipe, and then you're fucked basically. So. If you go in too fast, so if you're going, you know, if you're going in at fourth gear or something, and you're just gonna like think you're gonna go through it, like basically the water will just decelerate you, and then you'll like stop, and then you've had it. So yeah, little technique. I always want to have one of those cars where the exhaust comes up. You know, like there's like a Land Rover or a Toyota, you know, truck where you have the thing comes up above the cab. That's always looks very cool. It'd probably look very stupid on this car. So anyway, and this is actually 4x4 actually, this car, but it's one of those, it's a Skoda Octavia. That's the kind of car I drive. This is the kind of car that Vanessa bought, so this is the kind of car I drive. So I don't really know anything about cars. Like people are always saying, like, you know, what's its engine? I'm like, I don't know, it's like black something, black engine. So it's a diesel engine. Anyway, so on the subject of cars, what's been going on? So I was in Sheffield for a while. So I'm on tour, by the way. So I've been touring around in theatres. So far I've done Sheffield, Buxton, Leeds, Manchester, Stirling, and I'm in Inverness tonight. And then I'm in, where else am I in? Reged and Penrith and Lancaster and all sorts of, all over the place. The numbers, because of the virus of unknown origin, the numbers have been less. Like the last two tours I did over the last, you know, few years, they always kind of sold out. Like I would say like 90% of them sold out. Where this time you've got, you know, like, much reduced numbers, like 150, you know, like 300 to 150. So where before you'd have, you know, 500, you know, 300, you know, you'd, so anyway, so it's, but it kind of is what it is, really. Usually when you go on tour, usually if I went on tour, I'd make enough money to sort of sustain myself for a couple of years. But I don't need much money to sustain myself, so don't think it's like I'm making billions. But it's enough. You can make enough money if you're paying yourself like minimum wage. You could probably get by on the money you make for like 2 years or something. So like when you're on tour, it kind of helps support the other stuff you want to do, like writing, you know, if you want to write a book, if you do like a Kickstarter, you can probably raise enough money to support you as you're writing your book. Like in the old days, you get an advance, but it's quite hard to get an advance these days. Going on tour is quite good. You have enough money to support like a book project, and then you make your money from your book project, and then you do another tour and that kind of thing. It's basically like hunter gathering. It's a like hunter gathering kind of lifestyle, which is kind of very effective, I would say, as long as you're quite good at hunter gathering. If you're not, you'll just starve to death. Where I guess most people have a job which is more like working on a farm, really. Like if the crops all die, you're fucked and you'll starve to death. So unless you can get on another farm, so it's living by your wits. That's kind of how it works. On the subject of driving, so I was in Sheffield for a while. Saw my kids, which was good. Not seen them for ages. I've probably only seen them 3 times in the last 2 years. So, but that is quite good with Zoom and just telephones. So I don't really feel like I don't see them, because I'm, you know, I kind of ring them most days and stuff. So it's kind of nice seeing them in the flesh. Ella's learning to drive. She's like 22. She's like trying to learn to drive. She's done about 14 lessons, and she's a bit crap. Anyway, so I remember when I learned to drive. I learned to drive when I was quite old. I was probably like 27 or something before I learned to drive. I probably didn't get a wallet till I was about 37, or a watch. So anyway, I was a late bloomer. But I remember I passed my test, even though the driving instructor reckoned I wouldn't. Ha, showed him. And then I drove all the way to Scotland the next day. So never been on a motorway or anything. So, but again, it was a bit like when I skied across Greenland. I'd never been skiing before. By the time I got to the end, I was pretty, you know, I was okay at it. So, so I decided to take Ella on like a massive big drive. And so when I drove out of Sheffield, I drove myself. We drove in her sort of stepdad, like her, you know, her mum's husband, and my ex-wife's husband. Anyway, so we used his car. My God, it was like the crappiest car. You know, when you get on it, I couldn't even drive it. It was so crap. You know, it was just, you know, the clutch was like so stiff. And anyway, it was just really hard to drive this car. So that was quite good. It made it a lot. It's like, you know, the Romans used to practice with a much heavier wooden sword than the real sword. So it was a bit, is it like that kind of concept? Anyway, so Vanessa, Ella, so, and I didn't really trust her to drive the car out of Sheffield, because I thought she might crash it or something. So I drove out to like a big straight road, Ringinglow Road, famous road in Sheffield, and swapped seats, and she was like so crap. She couldn't even really get the car started without stalling it. And then, you know, she drove a couple of hundred yards, and there's some traffic lights for like road maintenance traffic lights, and then she stalled the car again and missed the lights. And anyway, so but slowly she got a bit better, and then we were going up like a steep hill, and there was a cyclist, and she tried to overtake, but she was going too slowly on a bend, before a bend, and then she ended up stalling the car on the wrong side of the road, and then, you know, some cars were coming down. So it was all very, I was trying to keep my cool. I was trying to be like a nice dad. I was like, what the fuck are you doing? You're going to kill us. And all that kind of stuff. I was just trying to be like, just start the car. Don't worry about it. The cars can see you. They're not going to crash into you. And just trying to build it, you know, get up to it. Anyway, she ended up driving for about 5 hours. We drove all the way to Buxton, went up this thing called Winnett's Pass, which is a quite famous kind of scary road for drivers. It's very, very steep. So I was like giving her my advice, like stay far behind the next car in case they fuck up and stall, and you'll stall. And we end up driving, so we drove to Buxton, across to Matlock and Chesterfield, and did like a big like 5 hour kind of drive. So it was very good, really. It was good. It just, you could see like how tense she was to begin with. Like she couldn't even talk. She was just so, you know, terrified of driving. And like slowly her confidence like built, and she felt more comfortable, and to the point where she was actually like just talking about things that were to do with driving. And so yeah, it's interesting to see to see someone learning. But I think it's a lot like climbing, where it's you're trying to make some things, like you've only got like so much processing power in your brain, and you're trying to move some operations into your subconscious, which they're not going to take up any of your primary processing power, if that makes any sense. You kind of end up doing things instinctively, like you change your gears instinctively, you're kind of slowing down instinctively, and you're then like using your full processing power for just looking around. One thing I kind of noticed is, do you know when you can see a hazard coming up? So you can see, you know, like a car coming towards you, and the road's getting narrow, or you have to do a difficult turn, or you're suddenly confused with the road layout. What she would do, she would kind of cross her fingers and close her eyes, not literally, but that was kind of what she was doing, and just kind of hope to kind of get through that situation. And, you know, 90% of the time, 99% of the time, you know, she kind of would, or people do. But I was saying, like, that's a time when you really need to open your eyes, you know, like, slow down, open your eyes, and, you know, pay more attention, less attention. Anyway, so that was cool. It's kind of nice when your kids get a bit older for you to be able to, you know, do stuff like that, and not just be the someone there who, like, asks for money and stuff. So, you know, but she never gives me any money. So, I've been on tour, been going around, doing all these theatres. One thing I really noticed as soon as I started doing my tour. So my kind of show sort of begins with Vanessa kind of decided to have this like 2-year sabbatical from being a teacher, and then it kind of talks about these like 2 years, or, you know, talks about going to America, climbing in America, and then end up climbing the El Cap another 5 times. But then coming to the realization that really it's a little bit just autistic, or just kind of nostalgic, like you're just going to Yosemite all the time because you're kind of nostalgic for the times you've been there before, and you're trying to recapture those kind of times, and you're not really doing anything, you're not really growing as a person or a climber by just climbing El Cap, like, you know, 100 times. So then we decided to go off to Africa, and I talk about going to like Namibia and Kenya, South Africa, climbing there. Then we have a break, then I talk about going to Denali again, like, you know, kind of more traditional kind of trip, but still kind of something out of my, it's not really, I guess it's not out of my comfort, although it was minus 50 up there, it's not really out of my comfort zone, but it was still something that I'd wanted to do a long time, so it was something I was probably scared of doing, so I hadn't done it yet. So I'll talk about that, and then I talk about how Vanessa didn't want to really go back to being a normal life after being away for 2 years, so we went to live in Kuwait, and about like traveling around the Middle East and, you know, like Oman and Saudi Arabia and, you know, like those kind of countries. So really usually when you do a tour, like for this, usually I kind of have all the basically all the stories and things kind of in my head and the basic outline, because, you know, everyone I would meet, I'd be telling some story about this trip we went on, and this happened, and this happened. So it's all kind of formulated in my brain, and I just have to like stitch them all together in some sort of, you know, some sort of way that's kind of interesting. But on this trip, because of the virus of unknown origin, I've not really been in contact with so many people. So a lot of the stories have just kind of remained like where they are, and, you know, have not really been fleshed out. They're just like the basic thing. It was funny, even just looking at the slides, I was like, I always like look through the slides when I go on a trip, and I'm always like, oh my God, there's like, they're all shit. Like, there's nothing here you can hang a tail on. They're all just like crap. And like that one thing I realized a long time ago, I'd often like look through all my slides, and like my physical slides, when I had like 35 millimeter slides, I would go through them and I would just end up throwing loads of them away and not even mounting them because I thought they were crap. And then, you know, as I kind of matured, like what I was doing, I realized like often the slides which seemed the least of least importance were actually the most important slides of all. Like, yeah, you might save all those ones of you, you know, beautiful sunset or, you know, sunset or sunrise or whatever, but they're really actually quite boring slides. So, you know, but with digital images, it's not so bad because you're kind of keeping them all there. Like, that's why I always tell people never to, you know, edit or delete images from the camera. Just leave them on the SD card because you never know. So anyway, so I started like pulling out a few images, and then I just kind of like, I know you're not supposed to like, you know, edit your photographs anymore or do any sort of processing on them, but anyway, so I have like a filter I tend to use, and it just it really kind of brings them into, it makes them look a little bit more cinematic and a little just makes them look a lot better, but it's a little bit more stylized, you know. The actual image is probably more like how it really was, but it makes them a bit grainier and a bit, you know. I don't know if you've ever seen like The French Connection. If you ever watched The French Connection, it's very, very grainy and very dark, the filming. It's all handheld, and it's a little bit like that. It makes your film, your camera, your photos more, you know, less Transformers, and, well, Transformers is stylized, really stylized. But anyway, it just makes it feel a bit more what was really going on, and it makes me look like I'm a bit of a better photographer than I really am. Anyway, so I get all the photographs together, and that would be like, actually, there is a story here. You put them all together, and then, you know, you sort of jumble them all together. You need like your Africa slides, you know, it's kind of linear. You got like a linear story, you know. You begin with about Vanessa, meeting Vanessa, you know, her kind of path as a climber, and then wanting to expand on that path, and then, you know, this having a sabbatical. Then you just build one thing after the other. And so I've been doing that for like well over about a month, which is unusual, because usually I would just do my slideshow like the day before probably, and because it was all in my head, I just had to put the slides together. So what you usually do, like once you put your slideshow together, like if you were a proper comedian, like, I'm not a comedian, but if you were a comedian or, you know, someone like that, you would do your show in front of an audience, you know, like a small audiences, and you would like edit it and you know, adjust it and get feedback, and then you'd end up with like a completely finished show. Like some people like would like record themselves every single night and go home and listen to it, and then just keep adjusting it. But I didn't really have that. So you just have to have a show put together that you feel is worthy of someone paying a ticket to listen to it. And usually, I think I said in my last podcast, usually, you know, slideshows are shit. So, you know, they've got a very low base, very low standard anyway. So you just have to be a bit better than that. And anyway, so I turn up in Sheffield and I start doing my talk. And I think straight away, like at the beginning, I have this story about these two men in the desert, like a kind of a, you know, a joke. Well, not a joke. It's like, it's kind of funny. I find it funny. But it's like kind of story. I'll tell you it. Anyway, there's these two men in the desert. They're living in the desert. It's like really, really grim. Cold at night, hot in the day. There's nothing to drink, nothing to eat. They're kind of scrabbling around, like trying to survive. And they basically have nothing, apart from one of them has a goat. And because he has a goat, the other guy hates him. Like, he's like, oh, look at you, the 1%, and all that kind of stuff. He like hates this guy with the goat. And anyway, one day, the guy without the goat, he's kind of scrabbling around in the dirt. And he sees something like metallic, so he like digs it up, and it's a lamp. So he rubs this lamp, and out comes a genie. And the genie's like, "Oh, you have released me from 10,000 years of imprisonment. I will grant you one wish." So the guy is like, "Oh God," he's thinking, and the genie's like, "You can have everything you want. You can have 100 virgins. You can have, you know, all the gold you want. You can have a palace. Tell me what you want." And he goes, "Kill his goat." So when I told the story the first time, I said like, oh, there's these two guys in the desert, one's called Muhammad, the other one's called Muhammad. And straight away you could feel like people like tensing up, that they didn't know what I was going to say. Like, in reality, if you ever go to somewhere where there's a desert, there's a hell of a lot of people called Mohammed. So it's not really a controversial thing to say. But anyway, and then so I decided to not call them Mohammed the next night in Buxton. But when I said, the genie came out and said, I will give you one wish, whatever you want. Again, I kind of felt people kind of like bristle a little bit, like, oh, that's a bit racist, the way he said that genie voice, you know. And so then, in the middle of saying it, I said, actually, I'm not going to do it like that. You know, I'm just going to do it like this. Like, oh, hello there. What would you like? Oh, yes, you can have whatever you want. So I really noticed throughout the first show that people were even more hypersensitive than they are normally. You know, like, people have just become, you know, like, dementedly sensitive, which I would say is actually the opposite. They're just like, they've become desensitized from normal, rational, you know, ways of communicating, you know, where people mimic people's voices, or you know, kind of make fun of cliches about other people, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, then I started putting a slide up of Dave Chappelle. Like, at the start, I had a slide of Dave Chappelle, and I said, like, oh, people, you know, someone last night in Sheffield said I'm like Dave Chappelle, and I said, what, like, you know, very funny and successful. He said, no, you kind of piss people off. Piss some people off, and because I thought it was kind of funny, and I said how, oh, my son had come to my talk and he was taking notes, and one of his notes was like, be less racist, and which was kind of a joke, really, because there's a bit where I say, like, oh, Vanessa wanted to go to Africa, but I didn't want to go because I'm really racist. Like, of course I'm not really racist. It's a joke about going to Africa. Like, if I was really racist, I wouldn't be going to Africa, probably. And I wouldn't be going to live in the Middle East either. You know, when I say I'm Islamophobic, I don't literally mean I'm Islamophobic. So, like, no, but although no one would have a no one has a problem when I say I'm an atheist, or when I say I'm an anti-theist, you know, which means I hate religion. You know, like, no one's got a problem with that. But if I say I'm Islamophobic, they have a problem with that. So, which is exactly the same way of saying the same thing. So anyway, so I started having this slide, and I was being very, very cautious. I thought by having this kind of trigger warning, you know, I was saying, like, the whole thing, and what I'm talking about is basically discomfort, physical discomfort, danger, dealing with things you've not dealt with before, like different cultures, wild animals, you know, all this kind of stuff, 50 degrees, minus 50 degrees plus, all these kind of things. So by the time I got to Manchester, I thought I'd kind of I'd started, like, editing out slides. I had slides where, you know, you were telling the story and it was just a bit flat. Like, you know, I'm like building up my, like, you're kind of improvising as you go along. You know, you say something just off the cuff and people laugh, and you go, so the next night you say it again, and you try and make it seem as you know, not scripted, because it isn't scripted. I'm just, like, standing there, you know. It's just, I don't have a script. I just have a slide to remind me what I'm supposed to be talking about. There's no, like, I haven't got anything written down what to say. I just have to kind of remember. And you just kind of go in with the audience. And although it's not, one thing I've often realized with me is when people go quiet, I think they're not enjoying it. But actually, some things you're talking about, it's not funny, or it's not something, you know, So I'm always kind of wary not to be too afraid of silence, but I am a bit of a whore when it comes to, you know, people laughing and stuff. So anyway, so I was like kind of, there's some stories which are like a little bit flat. So I just would kind of reduce, you know, kind of like cut those stories out. You know, they'd be like, we went here to climb Mount Whitney, and we walked up and we climbed it, and then that was it. You know, it's kind of like, does anybody really need to see a photograph of Mount Whitney? Like, so I would kind of edit it down, and it was like, I had a slide of, like, Vanessa in Camp to Iceberg Lake. We did, like, East Face of Mount Whitney, and she's come to Iceberg Lake, and we've got like some bear canister, and you know, so, and I'm like, oh, to be honest, I've had these bear canisters on loads of trips, but I've never caught one yet. And so that's kind of funny. So you just maybe have a little, you know, you just kind of have that one slide, and you just, it's just an aside. So it's just like a, you know, a little tiny thing. Anyway, so I eventually, I'm driving through some huge puddles here on the M9. I eventually get to Manchester, and by now, so I've done the, this is like the third time I've done the talk. So the talk should be, it should be pretty, you know, it's getting better and better and better. And I'm ironing out like a few technical problems. Like I'm doing it on an iPad now, because I was doing it on my MacBook Air, but it's, for some reason, it's very slow. Like when you press the next slide, like nothing happens. So that kind of like spoils the flow. Like the people, the audience are aware that there's something like, you know, like, you know, something laggy in the way I'm talking and the slides moving and stuff. Anyway, so now I'm just using it on iPad, which actually works really well. So anyway, so I did this talk in Manchester. Seemed to go well. Everyone seemed to enjoy it and all this kind of stuff. And then the next day I get like an email, and look, I didn't read the whole email, the attachment. But basically, a group of people left the show because they said I was racist, and there was something about one of them was still shocked how racist I was. And they didn't actually define what I'd said what was racist, which is kind of, you know, like, I really, if you're going to bandy around that kind of word about somebody, you know, it's okay for me to say I'm racist for a joke, but, you know, when someone is really sending an email to the theatre, you know, you got, what is the aim of this email? Like, what is their intent, basically? You know, they said, like, oh, he had this, you know, just having an image of Dave Chappelle, you know, as a trigger warning was triggering for this person, you know, because Dave Chappelle is a well-known, you know, TERF and, you know, anti-trans kind of person. And yeah, he is black, but he's probably like, you know, he probably represents the white, you know, it's like the black face of white supremacy or something. You know, someone like me, who's obviously a, you know, white supremacist, would really like someone like Dave Chappelle. So, and just basically a load of old bullshit in this email. Like, you know, he actually said he was racist. You know, he actually said he was racist in his at the beginning of his slideshow, and he was racist. That kind of thing. It's like, you know, it's I'm sure even the most like racist, you know, like hate preachers, don't say the racist at the beginning. You know, they would, you know, it's probably not a good idea, especially when you've got an audience, you know, in the UK, which is probably the most racially sensitive country on the planet. You know, like the most, you know, it's just, you know, like I think they have the blasphemy laws in Saudi Arabia are probably less strict than they are in the UK. And definitely when it comes to just being free to say what you want, you know, it's probably, you know, you go to any totalitarian country, and I think you'd find that people feel more free to, you know, to you know, it's like, hello, comrade, you know, like, you have to have, like, a little secret, you know, secret thing. But what is really funny was when I was in Leeds, oh, yeah, I did Leeds as well, so I'd done four, Sheffield, Buxton, Leeds, then Manchester. And when I was in Leeds, the guy who was running the event at the theatre was like a black guy. It was like, where are you from? And he said, oh, I'm from the Ivory Coast. So he was like an African guy. And I was like, started telling him about how I'd felt this like real change in the audience, which has been getting worse. Every time I've been on tour, it's been getting worse. Like I got banned from about three venues last time for making a joke about my shoes. You know, it's been getting worse, and he was basically agreeing with me with like, what is kind of wrong with people, you know, like, you know, I was like, maybe I need to get you to come up, you know. I say like, oh, I've got this like this guy who comes from who's from Africa, from the Ivory Coast here, and he's sitting there at the end of the stage, and every time I'd say anything, I'm going to like check with him, and he's going to like give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and hopefully that will, like, you know, because no one's actually offended for themselves. You know, if I made a joke about like you know, fat people, you know, how basically, you know, if we're going to all have to get vaccinated, we should also, you know, like, kill all the fat people or something, you know, because they're a drain. You know, they're you know, it's a social responsibility to either get thin or kill themselves. You know, if I said that, you know, if you're really fat, you might find that offensive. But if you're really thin and you find that offensive on the behalf of fat people, then I you know, you know, you can be offended, but you know, it's just this kind of like secondhand offence. It's kind of you know, they'd be like, oh well, that African guy, what does he know? You know, he's probably a white supremacist. He doesn't even realise it. He's probably racist, you know, because you know most Africans are racist. So it triggered a few thoughts in my head. Like, one thing is, you end up, you know, so now I have to somehow demonstrate that I'm not racist, even though there's no record of what I actually said that was racist. You know, it's just like a charge that I was racist. So racist, this person was shocked how racist I was. Maybe it was like, there was a bit where I was like, do not go up the mountain, you know, maybe it was that, like, it was like, I did like a kind of like African-y voice, like out of Tarzan or something. So maybe that was it. I mentioned Tarzan, maybe that was it. Mentioned fighting baboons. I mentioned, you know, maybe it's like a stereotype that all baboons in Africa are kind of violent and try and kill you or something. Or anyway, so who knows, like, what is going on in this person's head. So, but a few thoughts were, you know, in that, probably there was like 150 people in that audience, and I would say, like, either people thought the show was okay, or they thought it was great. You know, like, they really enjoyed it. They found it funny. I had lots of, like, interesting emails from people. Like, it's thought-provoking and everything else. It's not just a, you know, this is my holidays kind of slideshow. And so maybe, like, 1%, 2% were offended. And because of that 1% or 2%, you know, there's no question about how much we can depend on their judgment, or whether they're like basically mentally ill, you know, which is kind of very easy to become mentally ill at the moment because people's brains have all been rewired and jumbled up. So, you know, because of that tiny percentage of people, I'm kind of now on trial for being racist with no evidence and no real way of demonstrating my even probably trying to prove that I'm not racist is a sign that I'm racist, because really I'm white, I am racist, I must be just racist anyway. So I'm convicted already just by the fact that I'm a white, you know, I'm probably sexist as well. I was born in 1971, so I probably am. I often say, like, I think the word racism is a really pointless term. Like, is it like racism is a bit like, you know, like proper mental health issues, is when you see it, you know exactly what it is. There's no kind of, oh, I'm a bit bipolar, or I'm a bit racist. It's like, that is a fucking racist scumbag, or that is someone with like schizophrenia. Like, there's no, you know, I don't really, you know, beyond that, there's tribalism, and tribalism is hardwired into everybody. And, you know, the world is, the Western world is 1,000 times more tribal than it ever has been in my lifetime. Like, all these kind of anti-racist people, you know, the woke elite, or whatever you call it, the wokenistas, like, they have really turned the whole world upside down. They've made it, like, so, you know, so toxic for everybody. Like, you know, like, if I was like a minority, you know, like if I was black or whatever, like, I don't, you may, they may think they're winning, but they're not. They're making the situation a million times worse. And you can sort of see what's going on. You just look at any other country. You're like, you know, going on Africa, you can see it. You know, it's not about skin colour. It's about tribe. It's about the Hutus versus the, you know, the other tribe. It's, you know, it's the, you know, it's the, it's just there's something like hardwired into people. And you see other things. It could be in, you know, like a vegan diet, you know, being a vegan, or being a road cyclist, or, you know, being a boulder, not a climber, or, you know, it's all these a Mac, not a Windows user, you know, it's just hardwired into so many things. And you really need to try and, you know, get away from that kind of thing, because it's the pathway to hell. And, you know, just because you think your side is winning, you know, it doesn't mean you're going to win. Like, it just means you're going to, you know, you're going to, it's not good. So when you get Dion, who is the guy who's like producing the, you know, like the, you know, he kind of books all the gigs and he's like doing all the advertising. It's his company basically. And like, partly I'm on tour because of him, as in, I understand how tough it is having an events business through all this. You know, like, really, I shouldn't be touring. I should tour next year, you know, when things might be back to normal. But I'm kind of doing it more on his behalf. So for him, it's like, you know, he's kind of, you know, terrified because, you know, his business is like hanging on by a thread probably. And this kind of thing, like, he probably thinks there's going to be some, like, you know, campaign against me, or it's kind of hard to not on social media. Just kind of, if you're not on social media, then you don't really exist in that, you know, in that kind of thing. So for him, it kind of terrifies him. But one thing, you know, and I think he does view me as being a controversial person, but I don't view myself as controversial. I just think everybody else has just become, like, I've just always been the same person, but I think everybody else has basically become hyper oversensitive, like, to the point where they don't even know what's real or what's not real anymore. And but one thing I kind of refuse to do is to pay, like, a tax, you know, the tax of, like, oh, well, I, you know, like, I'm not racist because of this reason, and because of, like, you know, that, you know, I shouldn't have to pay the tax of that. Like, if someone just comes up to me at the end of the gig and says, or emails me directly and says, you said this, I think that is offensive, and give me the opportunity to explain or admit it was wrong, or I made, or, because it's basically in comedy and in anything, any conversation, whether you're talking to one person or you're talking to 500 people, it's or on this podcast even, there's a line you don't cross, and most people stay way away from that line. Like, their whole lives are full of chit chat. They never have a serious conversation with anybody whatsoever, and all the media they consume is a fucking mile from that line. Like, they have no grasp of reality, really. I would say, in my view, like, most people, you know, are clueless about the world around them, are clueless about themselves, clueless about each other. And the closer you get to the line, the more you're trying to understand yourself and the world around you. But that line is very, you know, it's very hard to see. And in comedy especially, like, when someone is, the closer to the line you are, whether you're speaking or writing or singing a song or whatever, the more piercing it is. You know, someone will say something that is incredibly moving or incredibly funny, you know, like, the, you know, the classic things, it's so raw and so dangerous what someone says, but it's also, like, so funny that you can't help laugh, and you know it's so dangerous to laugh because that person's taking you, you know, kind of to the line. You know, and I think that if you imagine, like, you know, you've got, like, barriers, you know, you've got some sort of safety barriers, like, those safety barriers are placed, you know, so far away from the line now, you know, like, because it's like, there's nothing to see here, there's not, that this is a dangerous, you know, people who are willing to go over there, they're kind of dangerous, you shouldn't listen to those people, just listen to us, like, we've made a new line, and this line is a safe line, where everything can be discussed safely, but kind of nothing can be understood. So, like, I've always been interested in, I've always been, I think because I'm like a tinkerer, I like to take things apart and try and understand how they work. And that applies to just life and, you know, all those kind of things, culture and everything else. So, but you can't do it behind a barrier. You really have to go up to the line and just kind of see what's there, really. So, but the role of a theatre, you know, the role of Netflix, the role of these kind of places where you're gonna, you know, tell people what you've seen or what your perception of what you find at the line is, you know, it's like vital. But also, you know, if people are just going to the theatre and they're just talking like the Gingerbread Man or something, you know, they're just doing like children's kind of theatre. Like I think most television now is basically what children's programming was, you know, in the 1980s. Like, it's all been dumbed down to such a level. It's not adult entertainment anymore. It's all kind of, you know, it's just it's visual. The same with like, you know, James Bond film or whatever. It's just kind of dumbed down, basically. It's just visuals. It's like, it's just big robots kicking the fuck out of each other. You know, it's all that kind of stuff. It's all drama, but there's no real meaning to it. So, yeah. So really, it's the job of the theatre to just fucking back people up. You know, like, you've booked them. You know, you've looked at their reputation or how many tickets have sold in the past, and therefore you've booked them. Now fucking back them up. You know, like, no one is going to... I'm not going to suddenly turn into, you know, some racist asshole like Zeke Heiling. Oh, you know, Mel Brooks can do it. Why not me? You know, if... but really, all our kind of media, you know, the doorkeepers, you know, they have to back people up. Because if they don't, people will stop doing it. You know, all those comedians, you know, any kind of play or show that's kind of difficult, you'll just get this, like, you know, like, safe, politically correct kind of dirge, just like bland, you know this kind of, there's a word for it, you know, where people aren't, they're not clapping or laugh, they're not laughing, they're clapping, if you know what I mean. You know, like, it's much harder to laugh, but it's much easier to clap. And you can see it in all the mainstream media, how, you know, it's, you know, I'd quite like to see a Doctor Who is like a, you know, bigoted racist. It'd be very interesting. You know, it'd be really interesting to, you know, why could Doctor Who not be a bigoted racist? Like, would, it's like Alf Garnett. You know, you had these characters who were like bigoted, racist, you know, homophobic, sexist assholes. But they kind of demonstrated how stupid they were. You know, like, we all grew up on these people, and we were made aware of how ridiculous being racist or sexist was, because of those people. Where I don't think that's true when you've got just these, you know, these people who don't live, you know, in the functioning, you know, objective reality that, you know, that exists around us, you know. So it's... So that's kind of, so you get all that bullshit, and I'm just thinking, like, well, what should I do? Should I just, like, cut out everything? I won't have a trigger warning. I'll just get rid of that straight away. No, nothing to do with Dave Chappelle, because straight away, you know, you have this thing where your audience, like, I always imagine you listening to this now, that you are like a rational adult, and you can take, you know, you can understand nuance, and you can understand, you know, the way I'm talking, that I'm not an evil fucker, and I don't hate anybody, and I've bent over all my life to help people for no personal gain. And you know, like, I have doubts, you know, I'm totally into like a multi-racial society. But I do have doubts whether, you know, a multicultural society is possible. And that kind of is not a controversial point. It's something borne out by a lot of people who were once, you know, completely into multiculturalism, but they've kind of come to the conclusion doesn't really work. And so maybe that's a controversial point, but it's something that should be discussed. There's not something that is called racist. Because if, when you have things like, when you stop people from talking about shit like that, you end up with your Donald Trumps and your Brexits and your, you know, wars in Yugoslavia and all this kind of shit, you know, the breakup of Lebanon, you know, civil war and all that kind of shit. Like, it's very important that people can talk about all these kind of things and not just be labelled, you know, racist, basically. So, but anyway, I guess we're on that, the road to hell anyway, because that's, you know, that it's kind of game over. So straight away it's like, right, I'll have to get rid of the trigger warning, and maybe we should just not talk about going to Africa, because, you know, anything I say is going to trigger somebody, and maybe I'll not talk about going to the Middle East, and maybe I'll just have to talk about going to Denali with Vanessa, but then maybe I'm being sexist the way I talk about, you know, Vanessa, or, you know, making jokes about being Irish. Maybe that's racist. So you would probably get to the point where you were just having to talk about going soloing, and even then you'd probably get into trouble because you're not using the original, you know, First Nation names for El Capitan, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. So you really can't win. And I'm a very strong person in, I try and hold myself to quite a high standard, and I am willing to completely, you know, like, if people kind of demand I do something that I don't agree with, like change my views or conform to something I don't want to conform to, like, I'll just, no matter how much I love them or I know they love me, I'll just have to not deal with them anymore, because I'm not, and it's not that I'm not willing to change, it's just that I'm not willing to be coerced into change. Like, I have to come to my own conclusion, you know, with things. So I feel and I know I'm like self-censoring, I'm self-censoring way more than I used to. Like, one reason I'm not on, you know, by not being on social media, I'm kind of self-censoring, like, massively. Like, yesterday after the gig, someone came up and he's like, oh, I really miss all your crazy stuff on Instagram. And, you know, that is kind of self-censoring, because I just, I don't do it anymore, you know. And, for all the shit that caused me, it was actually very productive, you know, it was very stimulating, and it was very creative, like, being able to just, you know, blab out some thought on Instagram and, you know, get, like, you know, likes and dislikes. But I have kind of self-censored myself by not doing it. And I self-censor myself. I don't talk about COVID, really. I don't talk about, you know, all the stuff around that, because, like, partly because I think it's so emotional. Like, all that kind of stuff is so raw in me, that I know that I don't want to, you know, like, you basically, if you listen to this podcast, you're inviting me into your head. And although generally, like, if I'm writing something, then you can stop reading and you can read something else. But like a podcast or something, like, every now and again, I'll listen to a podcast, and again, there's this line where they'll sort of overstep the line. And in terms of the COVID stuff, I just think it's too, it's just too much, really. Like, we're bombarded with it all the time, and I just don't want to add to it the chaff and the din of it all. So I am kind of, I do self-censor myself more often, because I do kind of view it, like, I would never stand up on stage and start pontificating about Scottish independence or Brexit or politics, because, like, you know, like, someone has paid for me to entertain them, and they've paid for me, I hopefully, to have some kind of mental stimulation, but I'm not there to do like a party political broadcast or whatever. Like an example of that, like, I really love John Le Carré. Like, I've always loved John Le Carré, and I just love everything about his writing. I love the way he observes the small details and the pacing, and you know, there's a lot of things that are unsaid, and I always thought he was a fantastic writer. But when I was listening, because I'm driving around, I was listening to the audiobook of his, probably the last book he ever wrote, and he's actually reading it. I think it's called like Man Running in a Field or something. And I was really, really enjoying it. And then he suddenly has this bit where the character says, he basically says, you know, like, Brexit was the worst, you know, the worst thing since, you know, like 1939 or something, and Donald Trump is, you know, at the face of white supremacy or whatever, and it's not that I necessarily would say I disagree with the statements. Like, I can totally understand John Le Carré's, you know, like, the kind of newspapers he's reading, the circles he kind of lives in, like, and the time he wrote it. But like, looking back, just, you know, looking back, you know, like, I really think it'd be hard to say that, you know, someone like Donald Trump was the face of white supremacy or whatever, or, you know, there's a lot of stuff. It was just, for me, whether you were, like, pro-Brexit or anti-Brexit, it just spoilt it. It was like it broke the fourth wall, because he showed his hand. He wasn't the character. He was kind of John Le Carré, like, saying that. He was, like, so angry about Brexit that he was kind of, like, showing his hand. And, like, a good writer, you know, say a good writer who was, like, heartbroken that Scotland didn't get independence, you know, should be able to write the story, you know, about someone who was, you know, like, anti-independence, you know, wanted the, like, a Remainer for Scottish independence. You know, that's kind of the duty of the writer, not really to show themselves. So it was kind of sad, really. And you always have to be aware that you always imagine that everyone who's listening to you thinks the way you do, but often they don't, and they might think completely, you know, completely opposite. Someone was talking about one of the theatres, like Roy Chubby Brown. You know, if you don't know who Roy Chubby Brown is, you have to Google him. But he was this kind of incredibly kind of rude, kind of obnoxious, offensive comedian, who was kind of around when I was a little kid. You know, people used to, he had this song like, I'm a wanker or something. And we used to sing it when we were kids. So, and he's still around, he's still like touring. And he was like banned from Sheffield recently because he was so racist and offensive. Now, I don't think you should ban people from appearing in theatres. I guess you can, like, you can book them or you can not book them, and they'll just find somewhere else to go. But if you book them, you should let them come, because, like, generally, you know, people who cross the line, and obviously I think Roy Chubby Brown definitely does cross the line, is their audience just kind of diminishes, really. They kind of die out. You know, people with old-fashioned ideas kind of die out, and the culture just kind of changes, and what is acceptable changes. I would, you know, I'm like 50 years old, and I think all my life I've had a very strong sense of what actual racism is. You know, like, this is not part of paying my tax. And as I said before, like, I grew up with my best friends were like a Sikh, you know, like someone from Ghana, a kid from Lebanon, So, you know, I was an outsider as a kid, and I kind of hung out with outsiders. So I think I always had a very heightened sense of, like, what is racism? You know, what is real racism? And I think people are the same. Like, what was once funny, like someone doing, Jim Davison doing Chalky or some African, you know, African kind of guy, like Caribbean kind of guy, or even Lenny Henry, you know, who's a black comedian, who is now going on around saying how racist, you know, racist it was for him as a comedian in the UK when he just used to go around doing the voices of Jamaicans. You know, it's you know, like it just changes, the culture changes, so you don't find those things kind of, you know, funny, and people find other things. You know, this thing recently where here in the UK, you know, the deputy leader of one party called, you know, basically the opposition and probably all its voters scum. You know, you just couldn't imagine that. Even in the days of Margaret Thatcher and Neil Kinnock, who, you know, obviously hated each other, you could never imagine them calling each other scum. You know, so maybe, I would hope in the future, you know, because culture can reverse itself. You know, civilization can reverse itself. It's not only like a one-way street. So it does change. But I would say in terms of what I'm talking about, it is kind of reversing, because you know, that hypersensitivity is not aiding in the ability to communicate and talk about things. It's the complete opposite. It's a tricky thing. And I think for those kind of people. You know, those kind of people who, like, there is a chance that person came specifically just to walk out and just to make life difficult. Like, I have lost quite a lot of work because I've had people, you know, contacting my, you know, people who paid me, sponsors, that kind of stuff, to say that I was, like, you know, alt-right or something, you know, just because I didn't follow the same, you know, didn't say the same thing as everybody else. You know, so there is that chance. That's what it is. You know, because ultimately the aim is to punish me for not being, you know, not being like everybody else, like not towing the line, not keeping my mouth shut, not doing what, you know, not doing the, not being a zealot, basically, you know, or not, but either not being a zealot. It's okay not being a zealot, because only minority can be zealots. But not just being a follower. And if you can't be a follower, then not just, you know, not just keeping quiet and staying in my lane, you know, like, so, you know, because basically you have to be made an example of. And, you know, that it's the Kendall Film Festival at the moment. And someone was like, you know, how come you never go to the Kendall Film Festival anymore? And I'm like, because I never get asked. And, you know, maybe that's, you know, maybe there's a good reason for that, but maybe it's just that, you know, like, I'm too, in exclamation marks, too controversial, and they just can't be dealing with any, you know, it's too stressful having someone like me or John Redhead or, you know, anyone like that, like talking at these events. It's it just becomes kind of, you know, I don't know, it kind of loses something. Like, you know, climbing festivals, outdoor festivals used to be quite rebellious things with, you know, fights and, you know, all sorts of shenanigans going on. But they've become much more safe and tame. Like, all the films are basically from Red Bull and, you know, Discovery Channel and National Geographic. And, you know, they kind of become just, you know, very corporatized and just a bit bland, really. But maybe, yeah, maybe that's unfair about Kendall, but maybe. Well, seeing I'm up on the charge of being racist, maybe that's a good reason to avoid having me. Maybe I'll have to start my own. Maybe I'll start my own festival in Ireland. I'll have an Irish festival, because I think in Ireland they still retain a little bit, you know, like Irish, you know, the Irish, like, you have a lot of this stuff, the politics about, you know, like African Americans in the US, but no one ever talks about the Irish Americans, or the Italian Americans, or the Polish Americans, or like you name it, Americans. You know, like every single minority that turned up in America had a really, really tough time. And you know, the Irish have a little bit of a heads up, you know, like a, you know, a lift up when it comes to being oppressed, because a lot of them, you know, there were quite a lot of slaves that were sent from Ireland to, you know, America and the Caribbean and stuff. So, you know, the original slaves of the Americas were, you know, North America were Irish. So, you know, so the Irish have a little bit more, you know, leeway. But, you know, maybe that's a racist thing to say. Who knows? So, but yeah, but these are the kind of conversations you can't have anymore. And, you know, we're kind of, we're much poorer for it, of not being able to just have a normal, you know, to say something without people getting kind of upset. And it will, I guess it will, for me, like, it will have to get to the point where you just get like an invited audience of people who you kind of, you know, self-selecting, like they're not, you know, they just come and they don't have to pay, but, you know, the people who are grown up enough to be able to listen to, you know, someone talk about something, and you just have to film it, and then you just have to put it on YouTube, and there'll be no live performances. And you know, I'm sure Dave Chappelle will probably have to do the same. Like, you know, Netflix are not gonna get him to do any more shows, because it's just not, you know, for that like 0.00001% of people who have never seen his show but are like, you know, arguing for him to be banned for life, you know, they kind of dominate kind of everything. Because at the end of the day, people are just cowards. You know, they're just, it's just the way we are. It's like how you survive. Like, you know, you just have to be a coward. You know, for every person who's like brave and fights for something, you know, like, you know, 80% of them die doing it. So what's the point? You know, just be a coward. You've got a better chance of, you know, and just join in as well. You know, if someone's bullying someone, just join in and bully as well, because that's a good way of stopping them from bullying you. That's my kind of advice. I always tell that to my kids, just you know, just bully. Or you can make it, or you can be like difficult to chew. That's a good way of, that's a kind of good way of, you know, like some animals are difficult to chew, so it's not worth it. So you can just be, I think I've tried that in my life as a writer. Like, I'd always attack people who attack me rather than just taking it, which is not the normal way of doing it. You know, I think it's like a working class thing. But you know, if you become unchewable, then people like think twice about doing it. So, so yeah, yeah, be difficult, be as rough as a file. That's not as smooth as a knife, but as rough as a file. So I know I've been rabbiting on a very long time as I've been like driving along the A9, the most boring road in the world. It's kind of a dangerous road as well. It's like it's just like two-lane road for like 2 hours, and every now and again there's like a dual carriageway, and everyone goes crazy, and then it like narrows down again. To finish up, so when I was talking to Dion about this, I was like, that's it, fuck it, I'm not touring again, I've had it, I can't stand the stress of it all. Like, it's already, you know, like, people don't get that getting in your car and driving all around the country, you know, like investing, like I have to invest like a month away from my wife and my, you know, like my 1-year-old son, who it's like missing his birthday, missing him, he's just started walking, you know, I'm kind of leaving her to deal with him and all that kind of stuff, and I'm kind of driving around, and you know, there's the super cold, there's the fucking COVID, there's the Delta this and Delta shite that, there's like, you know, like it's actually a high risk endeavor, you know, like you know, meeting, standing on a stage in front of like hundreds of people who are all laughing at me, you know, ideally, you know, breathing on me, you know, it's just, you know, it's like, I am like taking a fucking risk here. Like, yeah, I might make some money, but I probably could make as much money if I just stayed at home. But I'm doing it because I kind of used to like doing it. Like, I really used to. I used to think, you know, I would pay to stand on a stage and perform and tell people my stories, but kind of less so when I feel like I'm not allowed to tell my stories. I'm kind of confined into being this kind of a safe pair of hands. Like, you know, I've probably told this story before, but I once went to the BBC Sportspersons of the Year, and on the stage was like Gary Lineker or somebody. You know, like, Gary Lineker is like he's like a safe pair of hands, but he's so fucking bland. You know, he's like the blandest man in the world. Like, he just, you know, his opinions and the way he talks, he's just bland, but he's safe. Anyway, but then Wiggins got up there. Bradley Wiggins, you know, cyclist, got up there to get. He was like Sportsman of the Year, and you know, like there was a real electricity in the room. And everyone was like, what the fuck is he going to do? Like, what's he going to say? What's he going to do? And you could see, like, Gary Lineker and all these, like, knobheads at the BBC, like, quaking, you know, quaking in their knees. And, you know, it's like, but that's the world you're going to get. You're going to get a world of Gary Linekers, you know. Like, I even sent I've got a friend of mine who is, like, you know, really, really cool climber. He's just really, well, so where so he is, but he's, like, just a really... He'll be like fantastic on telly. He's like young. He's like good looking and all that kind of stuff. And I sent off a little film he'd made. And he's really good at narrating this film. And it's just a really good guy to, you know, if you're looking for someone to be in a TV program, he's like ideal person. You know, so I sent it off to this friend of mine who's got like a production company who does quite a lot of TV. And he basically said, unless he's like a minority, he's not going to get on television. And it's just kind of, I don't know, it's just, the world's gone crazy. It really has gone crazy. So, but this guy who's going to, or this woman, I don't know who it was, but if I was to come, anyone who would judge me as being something negative, anyone who would do that, if I was to come and sit in front of you for 2 hours, like, so I'm on stage for 2 hours, like, if I was coming to sit for you with 2 hours and you talked continually for 2 hours to somebody else, I guarantee you would be exposed as sexist, racist, homophobic, you know, xenophobic, somophobic, you know, you would be claustrophobic, you know, you would be exposed as being a fucking hypocrite. And it's very easy for you to sit in the audience and for me to have to kind of ad lib and trying to entertain you and for you to be... to judge me. But you know, these people are never judged, when really, you know, if you really look at what these people say, they are fucking racists. They are the racists. That's the crazy thing about all this. Like, you know, they are just filled with hate, and that I think that's what's the most annoying thing about it. It's like I'm not saying I'm a good person, but I try to be, but I don't think these people even try to be. They don't even know what being human is anymore. And I think that's just kind of disturbing. You know, that's, you know, like, they're kind of guiding society and telling people what should be said and what shouldn't be said and what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, when they're the least able to judge what those things are, really. And I guess that's why they never want to debate you. They don't want to meet you at the end of the gig and say, I thought that was racist what you said there, and for you to say, you know, what do you mean? Explain what I'm, you know, like, you said that, you know, some black people are poor and don't live in the ghetto and can have ID. That's racist. Like, don't you not know all black people are, you know, poor and ignorant and stupid and they all live in the ghetto? It's like, I don't think I really, you know. So a lot of these people, when you actually get them to explain what they're thinking, they actually have the most bigoted, racist, sexist, you know, intolerant, backward kind of views of people. So, you know, maybe that's offensive. Maybe that's a triggering thought. But I think I believe that you know, more than ever. You know, like my lived experience is these people are need to be chucked out. They need to be like not listened to, and don't give them the money back. That's what I say. You know, make them. You know, even Vanessa was like, you should get them. You should pay their ticket, and they could come and see you, and you have to sit right to the end of the show. You know, and see what the punchline is. You know, but why bother? Like, why bother? Because although you can do it, you can do your show, and these people can piss you off, and you can be like, that's it, I'm not doing it again, I'm giving up, I'm not going on tour again. Then you, at the end of the show, you, like, people come up, and those people, like yesterday was a couple who come all the way from London, like they'd flown up for the weekend just, you know, just kind of to go to this gig in Stirling, and you're like, Christ, like, you know, why, it's the same thing, like, why let those, that tiny minority of wankers, you know, and know-nothings, and you know, they really are know-nothings. They don't know anything of the world and of human nature and anything. But why let them spoil it for everybody else? So for those guys who came up last night in Stirling, you know, you kind of ran through the cordon where you weren't allowed to go near me in case you like infected me, you know. Thank you for thank you for breaking the rules. So it's a, you know, these like whenever you go on tour, you always have to deal with all this bullshit. There's enough stuff to deal with, you know. Oh, my telephone's ringing. Right, my telephone's ringing. I'm gonna go. Okay, bye. Hello.
Andy.
Hi, Paul.
Are you still driving? Riding home.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.